You're listening to the Short Story Geeks podcast at shortstorygeeks.com.
This is episode 5 of the Short Story Geeks podcast for June 14th, 2011, with your hosts, The Niche, Buck Turner, and Graveyard Greg. Sponsored by GnomeCo Publications, the hardest working gnomes on the web. At GnomeCoPublications.com. That's GnomeCo with a G.
Hello, and welcome to episode 5 of the Short Story Geeks podcast. I am The Niche, and with me this week I have...
Yeehaw, this is Buck Turner. As soon as I crossed the border, they gave me a 10-gallon hat, some cowboy boots, and a hilarious Texas accent. Okay, wow. Not really, but...
Don't ever do that again.
Yeah, you need to get... Hopefully you saved your receipt for that accent.
Hopefully I won't get shot for using that accent, but I did safely make it down to Texas, listened to last week's episode, and definitely agree that you guys could use an editor back on the show again, and hey. I am here to help.
All right, and we also have...
We also have Graveyard Greg, who does not have a Texas accent, but is broadcasting live from a recorded location.
Excellent. And Greg and I are trying out our wifty new headsets that were sent to us courtesy of our pals over at Bad Dog Books. So let us know how they sound. You know, hopefully we'll be a little less buzzy.
Oh, I doubt that. We'll always be buzzy.
Well, yeah.
It's all the caffeine that we drink.
Hopefully we'll be a little less insect-voicey.
Insect-voicey?
We're not going to sound like, you know, the whispering.
We're not
going to
be Kafka-esque?
No. Well, let's go right into the headlines this week, because we do want to keep the show a little bit shorter this time. Greg, what have you got?
Well, I have an article by a Marcia Richards promoting your book with short stories. Let's see. And this is a guest post on another blog, but we'll break it. We'll make it, you know, get to the meat of the matter, talking about how readers want to know your style of writing, and short stories are an excellent way to showcase your style. It's the hook. Short stories create the hook that will drive more interest to your novel. Use short stories to build synergy with your novel. What I really liked about this is that it says short stories allow you to have limitless commercials that will promote your novel. And I think that's just a great idea.
Yeah.
Because last week I was reading, you know, how I read Jim Butcher and his side jobs. It would have been great if he had had a chance to write short stories before his first novel had ever come out.
We were talking way, way back in, I think it was the first episode about, or maybe the second episode, about the short story that eventually became, was it Johnny Mnemonic?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That was a situation where the short story was also used as a development tool. Besides a promotional tool.
Yep, and I can't tell you how many shorts I've read that either preceded or became later novels within the furry community. That's a pretty common tactic nowadays, pretty common promotion. You get a few short stories or related works out on the internet to build some interest before your release date.
Like, yeah, whatever his real name is, I don't remember his real name, but the Save the Day author, he has
yes,
a short
DJ
story
Fall.
In or Volume 2. Did that
yes.
come out before or after Save the Day?
It did come out before.
There you go. There's a great
example. I think
example.
By about a month or so, but it did come out before,
and
yes.
That timing is just perfect because it's only like a month. If it's like a month or two, that will just make the readers want to read more. And then they'll see, hey, this guy's got a novel. Wait, it's based on that short story. Hooray, you know?
Cool. Well, what I have, let's see. There's a new Kurt Vonnegut collection coming out. Now, Kurt Vonnegut is largely known for his sort of surreal writing style. And he's written a lot of stuff. He wrote novels, he wrote short stories, etc. So if you're not familiar with Kurt Vonnegut, go brush up on your cultural literacy and we'll get back to you. But for those who are interested in his work, there is a new collection being put together. And it's not just short stories. It includes his most famous work, which I'm blanking on the title. Let me look it up here real quick.
Slaughterhouse-Five.
Slaughterhouse-Five, yes, that's the one. but it also includes a lot of his lesser-known stuff, and it's a good way to really immerse yourself in his work.
Yeah, I've always, ever since back in high school when I started reading a lot of his stuff, I've always been a fan of Vonnegut. Okay, we've got kind of a follow-up. We did a story about a headline about a preview story from the Rockstar Games LA Noir. They have actually put out an entire ebook, which is actually in most regions available for free through Amazon, iTunes, bookstore, etc. It's free, at least for now. Apparently, it's not... Oh, shoot, according to this story, by the time you hear this, it'll be 99 cents again. So sorry to say.
Really?
Unless you have a time machine.
I called it up earlier today and it was still free, but I suppose it might be going off tonight or something like that.
It's, according to the story, it's actually back to June 12th, which is tonight when we're recording. It's going back to its 99 cent price. But I haven't read the short story collection yet. I did see a couple of the cases from the game. A friend of mine was playing it, and I got to kind of watch and ride along shotgun as he solved a few cases, and it did look very intriguing. It's got a lovely black and white only mode that really kind of puts you in the right mindset, and hopefully these stories will do the same.
Yeah, well, even if they're not free by the time the podcast comes out, it's still 99 cents.
It's 99 cents, yeah. And one of these stories is by Joe R. Lansdale.
I remember they named a bunch of big-name authors.
Lawrence Block.
Yeah,
these
Block
are some good
yeah.
big names here.
Well, also in the mystery genre, I had the unhappy duty to report that Lillian Jackson Brown, who's known primarily for the Cat Who series of books, passed away this past week. She was 97. She wrote the Cat Who novels mostly are full-length stories, but some of them are short stories. Two of the books are collections of short stories, and she's a very popular mystery writer. Supposedly her only regret is that she couldn't finish her last book, so that sort of tells you how dedicated she is to her craft, or was to her craft.
Yeah, that's another name that takes me back. I read a ton of those books back in high school, as fast as I could get my hands on them.
Yeah, so unfortunately she has passed away, but her legacy lives on, so.
Oh, I remember her now. Yeah, she's had to read one of her books now in honor of her memory.
All right. So, moving on from the headlines, we have a little bit of follow-up and feedback from previous shows. We did get a few notes from various people talking about the length of the shows. Obviously, last week was a lot longer than we ever intended the show to run. As I've mentioned to Buck, you guys should have heard the extended full version. The edited down version that I finally released had a few painful cuts in it, but they really had to go, and as it was, it stretched on to, an hour and 20 minutes or something like that.
I blame Lovecraft, or Robert Howard, whoever we were discussing. I don't
remember. I don't know.
Let's just blame Buck. Buck, you weren't there.
Yeah, he wasn't there to keep us on track. So
that's what happens when you don't have an editor.
Exactly.
Well, that's what happens when you don't have, free Wi-Fi when you're traveling.
Yeah, that too.
We were also informed that the comments on the website were hosed, and apparently have been hosed for quite some time, which may explain why we haven't been getting any. So I went through and I fixed that, and it should be working now. So if you've attempted to comment on the podcast before via the website and have not been able to, please try again. If that ever fails, you can just email me directly, theneach@gmail.com. I will jump right on and try to get it fixed as soon as possible.
Yes, leave us comments. We want to know what you think. That you're out there, that we're not just spinning this off into the ether.
Yeah, well, we like to know what you are enjoying or not enjoying, or even just what you think. We do have one comment that came in. In fact, it was part of the email that told us that we weren't getting comments. And that was from Verwolf, with V's instead of W's. He goes by VV, or Verwolf. And he says, I've enjoyed the podcast and found them to be informative and entertaining. Well, thank you. You've managed to answer a few questions I've had, one for well over 10 years, namely, how does one correctly pronounce Nietzsche? The answer is Nietzsche. The G is silent, as in knife. He also says, if I may make a suggestion, you might want to consider setting up a Gmail account for Short Story Geeks, which then automatically forwards emails to all of you. That way you eliminate the psychological issue of, I have questions, but should I send them to Nietzsche, Greg, or Buck? Well, actually, we attempted to do that, and we tried to set up a Google Docs account that we could all share, and it just sort of broke and didn't ever work properly. So I'll get back on that and try it again when I have the time. Right now I'm sort of mired in the Suburban Jungle books. But in the meantime, if you send a Short Story Geeks email to any of us, we will forward it on to each other. I mean, we're doing this collaboratively, so you don't have to worry about who to send it to. If in doubt, send it to me, and I'll make sure it gets to the right parties. And he also sent us a long discussion-worthy email, which we will get to in the discussion section. And with that, actually, that's a good time to segue into it. So let's have a little bumper, and we'll call up the discussion.
Good old Nietzsche. Good old segue Nietzsche.
Hello, listeners. How are you? Fantastic. Because you're listening to the Short Story Geeks podcast at shortstorygeeks.com. I'm wearing a headset.
Not actually Isaiah Mustafa. Isaiah Mustafa's fees are way out of our budget. Void where prohibited.
So here we are in the discussion section, and what we're going to discuss is Verwolf's email. And I'll just read it out here, and then we'll let everybody comment on it. Greetings, geeks! I've been writing off and on for a few years. However, I find I have very little to show for it aside from a number of half-finished stories. Yeah, who doesn't know how that feels? Oftentimes, I'll be trying to write on one story when I'll have an idea for another story I'm writing. Not wanting to lose the idea, I'll jot it down as a note, but I end up derailing my train of thought for the story I'm trying to work on. Any tips or suggestions for handling a muse which loves to torment you? Get used to it. In one story I've been working on, a person is relating a story to the main character. Within that narrative, I find myself writing characters which give further narratives. So a story within a story within my story. I realize too many layers of story get silly rather quickly, like a chain of flashbacks, and considered revising the sub-narratives to be limited to a paragraph or two. But then it felt like those characters were just bad storytellers and didn't necessarily cover all the info I wanted to cover in the narrative. Is there a good general rule of thumb for when you're giving too much narrative within the frame of another story? I think that's all for now, but I will say, Buck, welcome to Texas, and hope to see you at Furry Fiesta next year. So until next time, keep your pencil sharp, your spell checker engaged, and remember paperclips know very little about proper grammatical forms.
Amen to that.
Yeah. Right. So what have you guys got to say about going down the creative rabbit hole?
Well, suggestions for handling a muse which loves to torment you. No, that's not me, by the way. I am not your muse, although now that you mention it. And also, is there any general rule of thumb for when you're giving too much narrative within the frame of another story? I think both of those can have one answer. Focus. If you get too spread out, you are going, you know, you're going to lose focus on things. You need to focus. Be like a laser beam. That muse who loves to torment you, focus. Well, I would say focus on destroying her, but then you wouldn't have anything to write about. But focus is always a good thing. If there are too many distractions, or you let yourself get distracted by, you know, other ideas for short stories, yeah, great, jot it down, but try to work on the main story. Otherwise, you'll be working on a novel for over 2 years when it should have been done in, like, six. Not that I would know anything about that.
You're working on it in two and it should be done in six?
Let's just say focus and a little bit of laziness, but that's beside the point.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think kind of, you know, the idea of just jotting down a note shouldn't really be able to distract you from a story if it's really that interesting. I mean, and when you say jot down a note, I mean, we're talking write a sentence, two sentences, maybe three, no more than three sentences. And then, you know what? Say, okay, I've got a note. I've got a file. I don't know any author who doesn't have such a file of things that will likely never see the light of day, just, you know, in terms of idea to time ratio. But, you know, after three sentences, you cut, you say, hey, I've got the idea down. Get, you know, back to what you, you know, really want to be working on, which is a story that you actually want to finish, that you've been spending more time on.
It sounds like his muse doesn't really want to torment him, then it has attention deficit disorder.
Well, you know, there's a thing about that is sometimes what you've got there is an avoidance mechanism. There's a lot of energy and excitement involved in starting a story, and then there's a lot of dog work involved in completing a story.
Continuing completing it.
Yeah, and so what you end up doing is when it starts becoming like work, you know, when you get into the middle or get... you know, get to the point where you're starting to actually have trouble, suddenly your muse, which is has a childlike quality, which is absolutely vital for creativity, gets bored and says, this is too much like work. Hey, here's a shiny new idea. Work on that. But the problem is, as soon as you start doing that, the shiny new idea sooner or later becomes work again, and poof, here comes a new idea. And you need to sort of recognize, I mean, I don't know if it's necessarily true in Wolf's case. I know it's something that happens to me.
Mm-hmm.
And really, what you need to do in that situation is recognize that's what's happening. And as soon as you sort of realize that your subconscious is trying to play tricks on you, that's a good way of making your superego or whatever, however you want to frame it, come back and say, you know, we're not falling for that. Get back to work.
Focus.
So, yeah. I mean, it's basically the same thing, but I'm looking at it as more of a diagnostic issue. What is causing the lack of focus?
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully when you realize what's going on, that'll help you implement your focus.
Yeah, and I mean, there's another flip side to that, too. If your primary story, if you ever get to the point, and plenty of authors do, where they kind of get a draft out, they kind of sit down and say, okay, I've kind of reached the limits of that idea, and it's not any good, well, then you're justified in shoving it off to the side.
Yeah.
You know, the key is actually getting something finished to the point where you can really look at it as a whole and say, yes, it's good or no, it's not. I mean, to move on just because you have this shiny new idea isn't doing you any favors, but, you know, at the same time, belaboring a story that doesn't have a lot of value or interest to you or, you know, necessarily other people is not going to necessarily be helpful either.
Yeah, but that, I mean, that's something where you have to get in and do some of the actual grunt work to know that you have explored the idea.
Yeah, you have to get all the way through the story and an editing pass, maybe two, before you can really kind of get to that and say, you know what, doesn't have much merit. But you really do have to kind of fight through those, ooh, new shiny idea,
yeah,
to finish something before you can really make that call.
And as mentioned before, if you have a shiny new idea, write it down, just put it in a file somewhere, and say, that is a very cool idea, thank you very much, subconscious, I'll deal with that later, and go back to work. I recommend always having a good relationship with your muse whenever possible. I don't, you know, I'm not one of these authors who actually has a sort of anthropomorphized idea of what a muse is. I'm talking completely metaphorically here. But understanding that your muse likes to come up with creative ideas, that's what makes it a muse, you know, and being accepting of that will take you a lot further than just sort of getting mad and frustrated, because using the metaphor further, if you abuse your muse, it gets annoyed and goes away, and you don't want that to happen. Now, on the second part of the question, talking about the structure of the narrative and flashbacks within flashbacks, and how far down do you go? I mean, it's flashbacks all the way down, as to coin a phrase. That really depends on the nature of your story. I mean, if you look at Call of Cthulhu, which is one of the best short stories ever written, it is all flashbacks. And it's not only all flashbacks, but it's multiple interrupt flashbacks. The main frame of the story is this guy telling about these things that these other people have told him. So you go from the main frame of the story, this guy talking, to the person he talked to, and that person starts talking about the people he talked to, and then that person is talking about the people they've talked to. It's this, like, this Russian nesting doll of plot. And then the very center is Cthulhu rising up out of the sea and the horribleness that's attached to that, you know. And that's a great story. But certainly you can't write every story like that.
And at the same time, those multiple layers are being kind of re-related and reconnected by a single person's perspective who has done this research and has personally interviewed these people. And each layer, he himself goes on to the new one. I mean, if you're writing a short story, you do kind of have to say, who are you following, or what characters are you focusing on? And you can see...
What's your main thread?
Yeah, you can see any of these other things through the eyes of your main character. You don't necessarily, you know, when you kind of say it's these sub-narratives and these characters are bad storytellers, well, maybe these characters themselves shouldn't be relating the story, but your narrator or your main character should be experiencing something about it.
Yeah. When you're writing one of these scenes, always know why it's there. I mean, don't just write a scene because it pops in your head. I mean, you can do that in the first draft. A lot of writers just write whatever comes to them and they go back and refine it later. If you find yourself getting deep in the weeds of going further and further down layers, figure out what it is you're trying to get across there. You know, what is the purpose of this scene? What is it doing? What is it bringing to the story? Especially in a short story, every scene, every paragraph needs to justify its existence. You know, and if you look at one of these segments and realize it's not doing anything, cut it out.
Also, a lot of times, especially the first time you're writing a story or when you're first coming up with this idea, there's a lot of things about the world that you need to kind of think about, rationalize, get in your head, get a history, what's the setting, what have these characters been through that makes them what they are. And sure, in the first draft, write it all down, get it all out. But then you got to kind of go back and say, okay, I know all of this stuff about the world. What does the reader actually need to know to get the point of my story? And it won't be everything. You know, you need to answer a lot of questions for yourself, which you can do in the narrative the first time around, but that the reader, you know, they don't need to actually have that answer. They just need to kind of know that you know the answer so that the whole world makes sense.
And it may be a case where when you go back into the revision process, you realize this scene, all it accomplishes is telling this fact about the world. And this other scene, all it accomplishes is tell this fact about the world. Look at those and say, is there some other scene I could write, throw away these two, or combine these two into a single moment that carries both of these ideas at once? You know, economize. Try to make things do double duty when possible, or triple duty when possible.
Because after all, it is a short story, not a novel.
Yes, exactly.
Unless you're writing a novel, then that's, you know...
You're listening to the wrong podcast.
Exactly.
All right. Anything else on that topic? Did we talk it out?
Yeah, I think I'm
good
with
that. I think we definitely talked it out.
All right. Oh. Well, if, you know, you want us to cover it some more, or you want more detail, or whatever, just, you know, we have comments. We have comments again, so just click on the little linky and leave us a comment, or send us an email.
Or leave us a comment.
Or if we should have gone back and trimmed out half of that because we were saying the same things, let us know.
Yep. A little bit of other discussion from me this week. I want to talk about a story called Die Like a Dog by Rex Stout. This is part of the Nero Wolf series. If you're not familiar with Nero Wolf, it's a mystery series. It was written from the 50s to the 70s, more or less. I think the earliest ones are set during World War II, because one of the characters is constantly trying to go off to war, and the other one is constantly preventing him from doing it. Nero Wolf is this overweight genius who never leaves his house. He's also a private detective. So what he does is he hires other detectives to go out and do his legwork for him, particularly Archie Goodwin, who is the narrator for all of these stories. There's a ton of Nero Wolf books, and they're all varying levels of awesome. Even the bad ones are better than crap, so they're worth reading. This particular volume that Die Like a Dog is from is called Three Witnesses. It's a collection of three mid-length stories, I'd say. And Die Like a Dog is one of them. And what you need to know about Archie Goodwin is that he is a well-dressed, very confident ladies' man, smart aleck, man about town. And the thrust of this story is he's trying to return a raincoat. And the person he tries to return the raincoat to when he gets to his house, there's been a murder there. So Archie leaves. But when he leaves, a dog follows him from the house. This dog ends up being wanted by the police as a quote-unquote witness to the crime, and lots of silliness ensues. But I'm going to read a section about just basically the beginning to give you a feel for what Nero Wolf is like. I do sometimes treat myself to a walk in the rain, though I prefer sunshine when there's not enough wind to give the dust a whirl. That rainy Wednesday, however, there was a special inducement. I wanted his raincoat to be good and wet when I delivered it. So with it on my back and my old brown felt on my head, I left the house and set out for Arbor Street, some 2 miles south in the village. Halfway there, the rain stopped, and my blood had pumped me warm, so I took the coat off, folded it wet side in, hung it on my arm, and proceeded. Arbor Street, narrow and only 3 blocks long, had on either side an assortment of old brick houses, mostly of 4 stories, which were neither spick nor span. Number 29 would be about the middle of the first block. I reached it, but I didn't enter it. There was a party going on in the middle of the block. A police car was double-parked in front of the entrance to one of the houses, and a uniformed cop was on the sidewalk in an attitude of authority toward a small gathering of citizens confronting him. As I approached, I heard him demanding, "Whose dog is this?" referring evidently to an animal with a wet black coat standing behind him. I heard no one claim the dog, but I wouldn't have anyway, because my attention was diverted. Another police car rolled up and stepped behind the first one, and a man got out, pushed through the crowd to the sidewalk, nodded to the cop without halting, and went in the entrance, above which appeared the number 29. The trouble was, I knew the man, which is an understatement. I did not begin to tremble at the sight of Sergeant Pearly Stebbins of Manhattan Homicide West, which is also an understatement, but his presence and manner made it a cinch that there was a corpse in that house, and if I demanded entry on the ground that I wanted to swap raincoats with a guy who had walked off with mine, there was no question what would happen. My prompt appearance at the scene of a homicide would arouse all Pearly's worst instincts, backed up by reference to various precedents, and I might not get home in time for dinner. I'm going to skip ahead a little. So the dog follows Archie home, and impresses him by running out into traffic to retrieve Archie's hat when the wind blows it off. My idea was to take my hat hound upstairs to my room, give him some refreshment, and phone the ASPCA to send for him. But there was no sense in passing up such an opportunity for a little buzz at Wolf. So after letting us in and leaving my hat at the raincoat on the rack in the hall, I proceeded to the door to the office and entered. "Where the devil have you been?" Wolf asked grumpily. "We were going over some lists at 6 o'clock, and it's 6:45. He was in his oversized chair behind his desk with a book, and his eyes hadn't left the page to spare me a glance. I answered him, taking that damn raincoat, only I didn't deliver it because... "What's that?" he snapped, and he was glaring at my companion. "A dog." "I see it is. I'm in no temper for buffoonery. Get it out of here." "Yes, sir, right away. I can keep him in my room most of the time, but of course he'll have to come downstairs and through the hall when I take him out. He's a hat hound. There's a sort of problem. His name is Nero, which, as you know, means black, and of course I'll have to change it. Ebony would do, or Jet, or Inky, or, bah, Flummery." "No, sir. I get pretty darn lonesome around here, especially during 4 hours a day you're up in the plant rooms. You have your orchids, Fritz has his turtle, and Theodore has his parakeets up in the potting room. Why shouldn't I have a dog? I admit I'll have to change his name, though he is registered as Champion Nero Charcoal of Bantyscoop. I have suggested..." I went on talking only because I had to. It was a fizzle. I'd expected to induce a major outburst, even possibly something as frantic as Wolf leaving his chair to evict the beast himself. And here he was gazing at Nero with an expression I had never seen him aim at any human, including me. I went on talking, forcing it. He broke in. "It's not a hound. It's a Labrador Retriever." That didn't faze me. I'm never surprised at any display of knowledge by a bird who reads as many books as Wolf does. "Yes, sir," I agreed. "I only said hound because it would be natural for a private detective to have a hound." "Labradors," he said, "have a whiter skull than any other dog for brain room. A dog I had when I was a boy in Montenegro, a small brown mongrel, had a rather narrow skull, but I did not regard it as a defect. I do not remember that I considered a dog to have a defect. Today I suppose I'd be more critical. When you smuggled that creature in here, did you take it into account the disruption it would cause in his household?" It had backfired on me. I had learned something new about the big fat genius. He would enjoy having a dog around, provided he could blame it on me and so be free to beef when he felt like it. So that sort of gives you an idea of the relationship between Archie and Nero. It's sort of like Grumpy Old Men, the detective series, and it's very entertaining, so I highly recommend it. And that's Die Like a Dog.
Beautiful. Simply beautiful.
Thank you. Next, we have Greg with...
We have me. I found a little short story by, inadvertently by the Niche when you tweeted about Christine Rose on marketing mochas and mayhem. I then decided, since I did not want to talk about Cory Doctorow, no offense, Mr. Doctorow, but I've been reading your short stories and stuff, and I can only talk about it so much.
It's time for something new.
Time for something new. So I found Christine Rose's alter ego, O.M. Gray. The story is a tall order, and it's dramatic. It deals with a couple in a coffee place, probably Starbucks or, you know, some generic coffee place. The only problem is they are a couple, but they're also married to other people. So, with that in mind, you eventually learn that they are in love. The woman's husband knows, and he is okay with this. The male's wife is not okay with this. So, you know, that generates some drama, and unfortunately, it ends unresolved. It almost sounds like that this is a snippet of a larger story. I'm guilty of writing those myself, and I feel that there should have been something more to this, and there isn't. It's well written. The dialogue is great. I was not bored when I was reading this. That's always a good thing. Except it ended.
Just no resolution.
There is no resolution. Could it be that it is part of a larger story? I don't know. There was no hint about it. So
maybe it's a promotional short story for a forthcoming novel that has not yet been announced.
She needs to put a link on it. There should have been a link. There should be some information. However, I did some detective work and found it is part of a collection of short stories, poetries, and articles called Caught in the Cogs. So I don't think it's part of a larger story. I think that was just, she just, you know, wrote it, did it, finished it. It will probably appeal to some people. They probably love those kind of stories where, you know, it's open-ending. Anything could happen. Nothing is resolved. It could be something like that.
Sounds more like it was a scene than a story.
Well, sometimes life is like that.
Sometimes life is like that.
Life doesn't have to make sense like fiction does.
Yeah, but unfortunately, we're talking about fiction here.
So. We are talking about fiction, but all in all, I put a link in the show notes if anyone is interested in reading it. It is a short story, and it won't take much of your time. So read it. If you disagree with me, that's fine. I don't have to listen, though.
All right. Buck, what have you got?
Okay, I've got a story here by Catherine Valenti. She's an author. She's got a couple of novels out that have come highly recommended that I have not yet managed to pick up. But those would be Palimpsest and a new one which won the Andre Norton Award, The Girl Who Circumnavigated Fairyland in a Ship of Her Own Design, of her own making, actually. But she had a older short story that was actually published in Clark's World, The Radiant Car Thy Sparrows Drew, and there will be a link in the show notes. But I figured that would be a nice way to kind of get in and read her a little bit, see what it's all about. And it actually is quite a lovely story. It's just the language is very luxurious and almost decadent. It's a fantasy book, well, fantasy short story that's somewhere between fantasy and sci-fi and an alternate history. They reference 1986, just kind of to read the opening paragraph sets a little bit more about how the technology of the world feels. Being unable to retrace our steps in time, we decided to move forward in space. Shall we never be able to glide back up the stream of time and peep into the old home and gaze on the old faces? Perhaps when the phonograph and kinesiograph are perfected and some future worker has solved the problem of color photography, our descendants will be able to deceive themselves with something very like it, but it will be but a barren husk, a soulless phantasm and nothing more. Oh, for the touch of a vanished hand and the sound of a voice that is still. Wordsworth Donisthorpe, inventor of the kinesiograph camera. So it's a story about a documentarian, documentary filmmaker, and some of her exploits that resulted in her final film. It's a very kind of a loving and nostalgic look. It just kind of feels very sepia-toned, as kind of implied that there's no color photography in this kind of world-spanning jaunt between Venus and Saturn and Earth. So it just feels very rich and lovely, which is quite frankly keeping in tone with what I've heard her work described as. She also does have a couple of other short story collections out there, a couple of other short stories. It's not exactly short fiction, but a number of her works have been serialized as she was writing them, actually, including the Girl Who Circumnavigated Fairyland. She kind of did that as a something of a volunteer subscription service, posting chapter by chapter by chapter, kind of the short fiction that adds up. Mm-hmm. So it's, yes, definitely something that I recommend checking out. It's a pretty short read. It's available online, and check it out.
All right, cool. All right, so we'll have a little bumper here, and then we'll move on to this week's Bloody Rant.
Listening to the Short Story Geeks podcast at shortstorygeeks.com has been clinically proven to make you smarter and more attractive. That's shortstorygeeks.com.
Not actually clinically proven. May cause confusion or spontaneous fits of giggling. Void where prohibited.
The Bloody Pen of the Ranting Editor!
Okay, so listening to last week's show here, I heard Greg use a phrase there about killing your darlings and needing to
shut
torture,
up, Nietzsche. What?
To torture and torment.
That's your that's characters. Not usually how that phrase is interpreted. But
quiet, Nietzsche. I haven't killed my darlings in a long time.
and really, that particular phrase, it was not born of needing to torture your characters. However, I have somewhat, not just by Greg, heard it applied that way. And it is true that you need to put your characters in extraordinary situations.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't like to be mean to characters that they created and loved and want to see have a happy ending and be, perfect and wonderful. But if they're perfect and wonderful and they don't go through hardships, well, the story's not very exciting or interesting. So you do need to be kind of mean. But at the same time, that's not the same as killing your darlings. I've also heard it kind of used as a justification for cutting out parts of your stories that you really like, which is closer. Which is closer here. But it's not so much just about taking it out because you like it, but it's about, kind of what we talked about at the beginning of the show here in response to VV, about taking a pretty brutal look about what is in your story and what is it saying. Does it have a point? Does it move the story? Does it, move the reader? Does it really explain something about the world? Or does it just sound cool?
Yeah.
If it just sounds cool, but doesn't mean anything, or it doesn't drive anything forward, that is a darling. You know, that's a turn of phrase that you love, that you're so proud of, but it just isn't functioning. It's not carrying its own weight in terms of the story. And those are the ones that it's going to pain you to do so, but really need killing.
Yeah, I remember particularly a specific instance in Blackbird Singing in the Dead of Night. I had a very nifty line I thought about Stretch's lawyer, who was a world champion at not returning phone calls, that you were very insistent needed to go.
Yeah.
Because it didn't work, whether it did or not. I cut it out, but that's exactly the kind of, when you hear the phrase kill your darlings, really that's the kind of thing you're talking about.
Yeah, and that it's not that the line was not good. It was a nice turn of phrase, but it was really kind of belaboring a point at a very critical juncture in the story where things needed to kind of snap, keep it moving. And sadly, that was kind of a distraction too far. So, you know, it's something that, you know, I didn't necessarily relish taking out, but the, you know, when the scene drags, the scene comes first and the story comes first.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like a lot of authors, you know, you keep the old draft somewhere in a file, in a box. You know, you cut out the lines and you keep them in your little word pad of inspiration. And maybe they don't work in that story, but maybe you'll be able to come back to them and make them work in something else. Or maybe it'll kind of jumpstart your muse in the story that you're working on when it comes down to it. But you do need to take that hard look about what the lines are doing for your story. Do they fit? Are they driving the story? Especially in a short story, you can't be too languid. You know, I know I just praised, you know, Catherine Valenti's.
Yeah, and in her case, the languidness is part of what makes the story work.
Exactly. And, you know, even as the language itself is languid, the story is not. It keeps moving. You know, the language serves that atmosphere and story very well. And, you know, I'm sure she had lines that she loved that she cut to get it down to where it is. And as an author, that's one of the hardest things to do, is to cut out that clever line you're very proud of. But if it's not driving the need to be, then it sadly has to go in the kill file.
And that can be very difficult, but in the end, you gotta trust your editor.
Yep.
Yeah, well, Greg's sense of killing your darlings, you know, torturing your characters. I'm not picking on you, Greg. I'm just using that as, you know, it is an important point that your characters need to have conflict. They need to have things go wrong, you know, in order to make a story worth reading. Doesn't necessarily mean you have to be vicious to them all the time, Greg. But
always vicious to them. I give them a break. Usually, I call it. It's when I'm on hiatus, but that's beside the point.
Yeah. That's not, when people say kill your darlings, they're not talking about deliberately torturing your characters. They're talking about things that you as the writer have fallen in love with that may or may not be good for the story.
Yeah, though I have heard it told as advice to authors that, you know, put yourself in that situation mentally and imagine the worst thing that could possibly happen and then do that to your characters. Just as, you know, again, it's a short story or a long story, but you got to make it, you know, interesting or entertaining, or you got to give the reader some stakes to keep them turning that page.
Yeah, it's particularly true in short stories where you pretty much have your climax as soon as you have the story. You know, you don't have time to build up to it, so you have to hit them early on with the biggest thing you got. Got any further input on this, Mr. Greg over there?
I'm just a horrible person if I'm imagining putting myself in that situation. And I'm sorry. But I would like to, you know, yeah, emphasize with Buck, killing your darlings. No, it doesn't mean literally killing anyone. Come on, people. I'm not that evil, am I? Yeah, I am. But sometimes to be in love with, like, even a scene in your short story, like, you know, going to the club, and then the editor says, what does this really have to do with the theme of games? And I'm thinking, yeah, you're right. Let's just get rid of that scene altogether and make it something different.
Yeah, I did that to you too, didn't I?
You know what,
I think I did that to everybody.
But the thing is, though, I love that short story more than I love the original. So much so that I said, you know, that I put it up on Smashwords.
Yeah. And, well, I mean, that's what an editor's for.
I know. But that's the other funny thing. The first editor made that short story, because that was, and editors, they don't always agree. But I think if the other editor is listening, God knows he probably isn't, and I don't care. But your version is better, Buck.
Well, that and as I recall, the other editor had rather a different point behind his editing. So, so I mean,
wow! Now I'm all curious. I'll tell you.
But yeah, I mean, the different editors are going to push towards different things because they'd have their own goals. You writers have your goals. We editors have our goals as well that we kind of need to shape and mold, particularly when we've got to make things mesh with other people's work as well.
Yeah, but theoretically, we're all, you know, working towards a common goal of making the story the best story.
Exactly, yeah.
That's why editors can be awesome.
Yes, and that's why they have red pens.
Yes.
All right, so we'll have another little bumper here, and then we will go into the hooray, it's here already intro.
Listening to the Short Story Geeks podcast at shortstorygeeks.com has been clinically proven to make you smarter and more attractive. That's shortstorygeeks.com.
Not actually clinically proven. May cause confusion or spontaneous fits of giggling. Void where prohibited.
Okay, so this week for intro, I'm going to plug one more time that my Suburban Jungle collection, the entire run of the series, is together in three volumes called No Predation Allowed, and each volume has an all-new short story, and yep, they're very short. I mean, they're 1,000, 1,500 words, but they are sort of key moments that have been referenced in the story or have been referenced in the strip but never actually appeared before. They're more character driven, they're more sort of in depth than the strip usually goes, because that just works better for prose than it does with a comic strip often. And also, there is still a Kickstarter project going on for that. It is fully funded, hooray, but if you want to get in on it still, you can basically treat it like a pre-order if you like, and there are commissions and portfolios available, etc., depending on your level of pledge. And the more money we get, the more copies we can make. You know, so feel free to jump on. And there's a link to that in the show notes. Greg, how about you?
I'm, as usual, going to promote Pimp, whatever you will want to call it, Fang Volume 5.
Yeah, I think for Fang, you need to pimp it.
Yes, Fang Volume 5. We are accepting submissions. If you have an erotic short story, if you have a porn short story, we'll look at it.
It is a furry anthology.
Yes, it is an anthology. I should say it's an anthology, although I'm sure...
It's a furry anthology.
Oh, that's right. It's
not just any old erotic.
It's one of those anthologies, people. Furries. Furries, furries, furries. So if you have a furry erotic short story, or, you know, even a porn furry short story, send your submissions to fang@baddogbooks.com, but you probably would want to read the submission guidelines first, or else I will have to laugh at you. Also, I would like to once again offer a free short story. This time there is no code, because this is free all the time, until it's not. It's called Obliette. This is also the short story, coincidentally enough, that I spoke of how, you know, I wrote it, and it sort of just, you know, ends. I think it's great open-ended, but until I decide it's not great open-ended, it's going to be free. You can find it at smashwords.com. I put a link up to it. And coming soon from yours truly, there will be a Kickstarter project that I will be doing. What is it? Well, I left you a little hint in the show notes.
Okay.
And it's your fault, Nietzsche.
You know, I've always wondered how to pronounce that word, Obliette. Is that it?
I think it is called Obliette.
Okay. Buck, what do you got?
Okay, well, I did want to kind of take a break from Roar Volume 4 submissions, which can be sent to BuckCTurner@baddogbooks.com.
I see what you did there.
And instead actually talk about something that is currently available and I would love to see more people pick up. That is Roar Volume 3.
Hooray!
We are actually bringing it around. The largest furry convention in the world is, well, probably a week and a half away by the time you hear this. And that is Anthrocon in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I will be there. The Nietzsche will be there. And so will Roar Volume 3. Go ahead and pick that up at the Fur Planet table, and I'll be happy to sign it. There are some other authors there that I know will be around, including the Nietzsche and Kevin Frain.
I'll be happy to sign it too.
So definitely pick that up and take a look at it. And say hi. I'll be happy to say hi, especially if you mention the podcast.
Yes, definitely. All right. So as usual, we have our call for audience participation, suggestion, news items, plugs, anything you got, we want to hear about it. So you can put it in the site comments now that the site comments are working again. You can email it to thenich@gmail.com. You can email it to either of these guys. What's your emails, guys?
You first, Buck.
Okay, that would be, as I said, buckcturner@baddogbooks.com.
And I'm graveyardgreg@gmail.com.
You can also subscribe to the podcast. We have an RSS feed in the magic coffee cup of floating RSS logos on the website. Or you can subscribe to us on iTunes. We also are looking for reviews or ratings on iTunes to help promote the podcast. You can contact us by the various venues available on shortstorygeeks.com. We are also at shortstorygeeks on Twitter. Since Buck and I will both be at Anthrocon, our next show is actually going to be in 3 weeks instead of the usual 2 weeks. So that will be July 5th, and we hope you guys will come back and listen to us then. And in the meantime, do we have a sign-off this week? Anyone?
I actually thought of a sign-off that makes sense when you think about it.
Okay.
Novels are long. Short stories aren't. Read a short story today.
Right.
I didn't say it was good.
Yeah.
Save your eyeballs. Read a short story.
No. I don't.
Hey, it's better than what you've come up with, which is nothing.
Hey, come on. I record the show.
You know, there is always silence.
Silence? That's boring. Say
that's
goodnight.
The end.
Yeah, if we just stop.
Silence. Silence. No, Nietzsche, say goodnight.
Good night.
Buck, say goodnight.
Good night.
Good night, buddy.
Okay.
This has been episode 5 of the Short Story Geeks podcast with your hosts, Denich, Buck Turner, and Graveyard Greg, with additional material by Laurie Roby. Intro and outro music provided by the Rat City Brass at ratcitybrass.com. Incidental music provided by freemusicarchive.org and the PodSafe Music Network at musicalley.com. All music used with permission under the Creative Commons license or by its creator. Thanks for listening.
The king of segues. Not the king of graceful segues, just the king of segues.
You know the guy who created the Segway fell off a cliff on one?
Yeah,
you should be careful about that.
We're not talking about that Segway, though.
Yeah, there is some thought that may have been suicide, actually. Like he deliberately
suicide
drove it off
by
the
Segway.
Cliff. Yes.
Oh, dear.
Segways can be hazardous. Use with caution.